The Guardian.
From The Guardian, this is Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week, I meet actor-director Paddy Considine and actress Olivia Colman to discuss their visceral beast of a film, Tyrannosaur. And British actor Tom Hiddleston is on the escalator heading one way up. We discuss his star turn in Woody Allen's delightful Midnight in Paris. And Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw joins me later to review some of the week's other big releases, including Johnny English Reborn with Rowan Atkinson back in the tuxedo, Guillermo del Toro's presentation of Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, and the documentary 4 Days in Guantanamo. Yes, it's a rose-tinted edition of your favourite film podcast. It's Film Weekly. Many actors who decide to direct are sometimes accused of engaging in a vanity project. But with the release this week of Tyrannosaur, the actor Paddy Considine may in future be seen as a great director whose acting exploits have been his vanity projects. Tyrannosaur tells the story of Joseph, played by another actor-director, Peter Mullen. Joseph is a man caught up in a vortex of violence and rage and seems doomed until he meets Hannah, played brilliantly by Olivia Colman, a Christian charity shop worker caught in her own circumstances of violence and, like Joseph, seeking escape and redemption. I met up with the director, Paddy Considine, and his star, Olivia Colman, to probe further into the darker recesses of Tyrannosaur.
So what happened to you?
Fell off my back.
Okay. Well, you look like you need to go to the hospital.
Nah, I'll heal myself.
I prayed for you last night.
Don't think he heard you, love.
Why did you come here?
I was just passing.
There must be a reason. Do you want God to forgive you for something?
I don't want anything.
God loves you.
Does he now?
Paddy Considine, Olivia Colman, congratulations on your work together in Tyrannosaur. What an amazing, amazing thing that you've come up with. Was it a collaborative process? I mean, I know that you were his wife in the donk and long suffering.
I mean,
did you forget? How could you forget about that?
I know, I did. I forgot all about that.
Yeah.
We could keep talking about Hot Fuzz because that's when I first met Olivia was on Hot Fuzz. You know, collaborative. I mean, yeah, you should be collaborative with your director. And that's what filmmaking's all about, you know. But I'd written a short film and then that was Dog Altogether, and then I that went out into the world and. It always seemed like it was the beginning of a bigger movie.
Mm-hmm. Was it the intention? Because I remember seeing all the others talking to you when you took it to Bristol, I think, to the film festival there. It felt. But I like a short film that feels like a bigger movie. In fact, a sort of short film should feel like a movie all in itself, and it did. So when you were going to expand upon it, I thought, oh, I wonder where it can go.
Yeah, well, I've written another short for Olivia, and. With that character, and I guess a few people responded like and thought that it was the beginning of a bigger film and wanting to know what happened to the characters. So I went off and carried on from where Dog Altogether finished, just literally picked up the page and carried on writing. And I think in the first scene that I wrote became the sort of catalyst for what would become the rest of the film, because it was when Peter sort of goes in the charity shop and vents at her and makes all these assumptions about her life and her character, and I think that was the real sort of when it took off, really, because, you know, as a writer, you sit there and you go, okay, then let's see what she is putting up with at home. Let's see if he's right about her life.
Now, presumably as an actress, your job is to kind of give us all of that backstory in the 5 minutes of the short that we got of you. I mean, it was something that we could read in your face and your eyes. Anyway, did you ask Paddy, well, you know, I'd already thought that this woman had such and such a life behind her?
Paddy told me about a friend of his that the character was based on, and I'm not sure at that point how much I knew about her life. I can't remember now. But I don't think I knew an awful lot about her backstory during the short, and I was only there for a day in Glasgow.
It was a quick one. I mean, the truth is, Olivia got cast because I just got a sense of her as a person, and I just sort of knew instinctively, which is a very strange thing, that she was the right person to be in this to play that role, and it's what she brings as a person to that. It's her nature as Olivia. And I think, although acting's acting, you become other people, I think a lot of great acting is really playing on people's natural sort of persona, if you like. And so that part was easy for the short. Where it got difficult was with the terrain that became Tyrannosaur, because obviously Olivia hadn't gone anywhere near that. And, you know...
You mean in her career before?
In her career before, yeah. She'd never touched anything like that. And I don't think anything had been expected of her. Yeah.
To be honest, Paddy, not many people do go there, do they, quite that often. I mean, it's rare that a film takes us there anymore, and it's quite rare that an actress gets to do it. I mean, I was almost thinking, and I don't know if this is because the week before I was talking to Gary Oldman and Kathy Burke was in Tinker Tailor. It was sort of the last time I'd seen something like that was tough and gritty, is Neil by Mouth, which is odd because that's his directing debut as an artist, and I suppose it probably is an influence on you as an actor.
Oh, I mean, Gary... I mean, I remember I wasn't in film at all. I was still a student, and I saw Neil by Mouth in Brighton, and I sat in the audience, and that was definitely, I'm going, you know, you're talking to me about my life. And of course, not literally, but I'm going, this guy speaks my language, you know, and I've obviously loved him as an actor. And but he's a great inspiration to me. And it's strange how life works. It's one of those beautiful things that happens in life, in that I happen to be working with Gary on a film in Spain, and I wrote my short film in the hotel one afternoon because I was just so frustrated with acting, and he was the first person to read it. I gave it to him.
This is Dog Altogether.
This is Dog Altogether, and I gave it him the next morning, and I said, just tell me what you think of that and be brutal. And he just said, I love it, and if I didn't live in America, I'd produce this. You know, so it was great, and... it was a really great moment. So Gary, I mean, to have that is something that's incredible, and it's one of the brilliant ways that life works. And because when I wrote Tyrannosaur, Gary was one of the first people I sent it to, and I just said, again, just be brutal. And he just called me back and said, don't change a thing. He said, don't let them, you know, get you to change anything.
I love your face here, Olivia. You didn't know.
No, that's brilliant. How cool of him to... Yeah.
Did you, I mean, it was that, I don't know if it was something that Paddy brought up on the set, clearly not, he's never told you before, but Kathy Burke's performance, is that something as a British actress that you look to?
I am such a huge fan of Kathy Burke's, but you know, it's not, no, you've got to do your own thing, you know, and I admire so many wonderful actors. And I've spent years, you know, since childhood, looking at them on screen and going, wow, but it's not something you don't know.
Who are they? Because whenever I look at you, I kind of think, oh, no. I mean, you're you, obviously. But who were your inspirations? Kathy Burke will always say Irene Handel, which is kind of a really kind of left-field kind
I'd
of choice.
That Kathy, sorry, I'm not sure. I would say that because, you know, you love, obviously, I think Kathy's got the same qualities that Olivia's got in that people just love her. You know, and that's it. And
she's blushing.
You know, but Kathy's the same. I've seen Kathy do a couple of talk shows recently, and you can't help it. I'm inside. I'm going, oh, Kathy's back on the telly again.
I met her once, and I was so beside myself, I could barely stand up. I was so excited to meet her.
Who are your heroines?
Well, she is one. She's since we've been doing press for Tyrannosaur, I've really sort of thought about. Everyone's gone, you've done comedy, what made you do this? Like there's any choice in any actor's career. But there are many women who... Emma Thompson, she was started off funny. She's, you know, people have managed to let it go now that she started doing funny. And Kathy Burke and Julie Walters. It time and time again, and for some reason you have to explain it every time.
Do you think we don't allow people to be funny?
No, we don't allow people to do both things. People find that, for some reason, they don't get it. And it's people like Paddy who know that people can do anything. You're just an actor.
Yeah. Well, you could both do funny. A Tyrannosaur is terribly, terribly moving and powerful and all that. But in fact, it is the reason it's watchable is because there are about 5-6 moments of that are very, very funny as well. And I think that's a huge compliment. Yeah.
You know, Peter Mullins to me, I, as far as I'm concerned, this guy lives with like Jack Nicholson and Lee Marvin and all the people that I love. You know, he's one of them to me.
Amazing debut, Paddy, and wonderful to see you not being funny.
Thank
Olivia.
You. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Tyrannosaur goes on general release here in the UK from this Friday, the 7th of October. from T-Rex to something like that battle in A Million Years BC where the T-Rex takes on the Triceratops. Guardian critic Peter Bradshaw and myself will lock horns over this week's releases. Now, that is a link you weren't expecting.
I prefer to think of myself as the gentler Brachiosaurus. Really.
Do you?
Cropping a little green leaf in the corner of the frame.
I wondered if pterodactyl would be insulting.
Pterodactyl, well, you know.
Or brontosaurus.
That's how my face looks, of course, these days. Yes, Apatosaurus, as it's now known, of course. Yes, Tyrannosaur.
Tyrannosaur.
This is a movie I sat down to, having heard sort of mixed reviews, sort of whispers, sort of shamefaced whispers from some film connoisseurs that we all love it, but maybe it's a little bit too miserabilist. And I sat down to it with these sort of murmured warnings in my ear, but they really did fade away. I found myself being profoundly impressed by this movie.
Quite quickly,
and I found myself profoundly impressed really with Paddy Considine, who is making his directorial debut with Tyrannosaur. It's in fact a development from a short film he made called Dog Altogether.
Did you see
roughly
that?
The same pass. I haven't seen
it.
Oh,
that. Well, I saw that.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
It's almost the sort of, it's just them in the shop, Peter Mullen and
right.
Olivia Colman. It's sort of
okay.
That.
Okay, I hadn't seen it, but I know it's on my to-do list because, as I say, I was very impressed by this. It's clearly influenced by Ken Loach. It appears to be an allusion to My Name is Joe, giving him the name Joe, and to Shane Meadows. But to be honest, I actually liked it better than Shane Meadows. I think Shane Meadows has a tendency, and Considine has a tendency as an actor in his movies, towards machismo, that rage and anger, which are key themes, these are sometimes presented, I suspect, in a slightly macho way. Whereas now, in this movie, I found these themes treated in a much more clear-eyed way and a much more insightful way.
When you mention Shane Meadows, I mean, I love Shane Meadows' work, but it's his world, it's his vision of the
yeah.
world. Whereas this one seems much more real to me. And this one really makes me question who those lonely men are in donkey jackets drinking at the bar
yes.
when you go into a pub at lunchtime
yes.
or at 11 o'clock, actually. And
yeah.
this is the story behind them. I felt, yes. really felt that with this.
I felt so. There's something much more plausible and much more compassionate. I think Shane Meadows is in his way a brilliant filmmaker, but I think Paddy Considine has, if he goes on like this, I think has shown himself to be Shane Meadows' equal in many ways.
That's Tyrannosaur, starring Paddy Considine and Olivia Colman, and of course Eddie Marson as well.
Eddie Marson, another very good performance from him.
Peter, there are a lot of films out, as there are every week. This, you know,
yes.
last week, I think there were 18 films out. We couldn't possibly scratch
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable, isn't
Unbelievable.
It? This week, it feels like a sort of minnow of a week, but yet
yeah.
there are sort of 10, I think, nevertheless. So we shall quickly skirt over a few of those. We're going to talk about Johnny English Reborn. We'll also talk about Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. You can tell me about 4 days in Guantanamo, because I didn't see that yet. And then we'll come back to Midnight in Paris, the Woody Allen film, which
yes.
is another major film of the week.
Yeah.
But if we could start with Johnny English Reborn, because, I mean, this is one of those record length between kind of original and
yes.
sequels. I mean, 2003 was the original.
Yes, I think what's happened is that they've just offered Rowan Atkinson money, and he said no, then more money. No, more money, and more money, and more money, and more money, until Rowan probably said, oh my God, all right then.
Do you think that's
okay.
why? Because he crashed his car recently, didn't he? Do you think that was the fight? He took a call saying, all right, you can have $7 million, and he
yeah.
got, veered off the road and said, all right,
I think he simply, I mean, his fee was simply, must have been just simply astronomical, really.
This is a facial action coding system. Its high-speed cameras record micro-expressions invisible to the naked eye, detect what we call emotional leakage.
Miss Sumner, I'm a trained agent. I don't leak.
It's a good cast. Richard Schiff, Rosamund Pike from the real James Bond movies, playing it absolutely straight,
yeah.
playing it dead straight, like the good sport that she is. Gillian Anderson.
Everybody's played it straight as well, to be honest, because I sat stony-faced throughout, and I found it very easy to do so.
I know. I've got to be fair. There were one or two gags which weren't bad. I was interested to see that the script was by Hamish McCall, who, of course, has collaborated with Sean Foley and done great stage work. There is some decent gags in it. One or two. Not many. God alone knows.
I don't know if he's a Bond spoof, a Panther spoof.
It's a Clouseau-Bond
yeah.
hybrid, in a way. I mean, that's all it is. It is very 2D. It is like Mr. Bean in that it's designed for foreign markets, non-foreign language territories. Basically, it's sort of pretty broad slapstick, stuff to be hoovered up in Iran, where Rowan is a big deal.
Yeah.
And everywhere at
Albania,
all.
Albania, presumably. Yeah. He could be the new Norman Wisdom if he plays his cards right.
Exactly.
It's the last resting place of a character who was invented to promote Barclaycard.
Yes. Bob. Exactly. And there we are.
Peter.
You said it. You delivered the devastating death blow
just
there.
Came up with it.
I can feel the tumbleweed.
Peter, I found it rather torturous watching Johnny English Reborn, but probably you've seen 4 days in Guantanamo. I suppose they were much worse, but I could think it would work.
Four days in Guantanamo is a brilliant documentary.
So a firefight started. Did you guys make a decision that you were going to fight until the end?
At the time, he hadn't been charged with anything, much less tried. It was obvious to everyone who looked at the situation, including the United Nations and by then some American courts, that this was unlawful.
It is absolutely horrifying, and it contains somebody who I think is the biggest villain in a documentary. I don't think I've ever hated anybody as much as I hated the disembodied behind-camera interrogator's voice in 4 Days in Guantanamo. It's the story of how the youngest ever person to be imprisoned in Guantanamo, a guy called Omar Khadra, who's a Canadian citizen, was picked up at 15 years old in Afghanistan in 2003.
It's an extraordinary rendition.
Yeah, rendered to finally to Guantanamo. He was reportedly tortured. Finally convicted in 2010, after being imprisoned there without trial or even tribunal for 7 years, and allowed the lenient sentence of 8 years to begin then, of course, on the understanding that he pleaded guilty, which he has done. But what this movie has done is found the declassified video recordings of his original interrogation, which went over 4 days, by this Canadian intelligence officer, who was permitted to do so by the Americans, clearly on the understanding that a friendly-seeming fellow Canadian would make this kid open up and give them decent intelligence and basically condemn himself out of his own mouth. And when you see this kid realize that this is what this guy is here to do, he's not there to be friendly, and he's certainly not there to bring him home. He's there to make him condemn himself. And he realizes that dying in prison is a real possibility. And this friendly guy is here to make it happen. You can see pure terror in this guy, pure terror. And the interrogator is this grotesque David Brent figure, you know, sometimes friendly, sometimes wheedling and petulant. He has this grotesque habit of complaining about his own discomfiture in the cell.
Are real interrogators like, are they like the ones we know in the movies, the kind of good cop, bad cop? Do they employ all those tricks? Are they real?
He didn't look like that. What's so horrifying is that he looks so real. You suddenly realise he's not like a movie interrogator. He's like a kind of nerdy, as I say, David Brentish middle manager, who would say, listen, I don't want to be here. I'd rather be at the beach. Without any irony at all, he would complain about his own discomfiture repeatedly. He does these awfully transparent tricks of bringing sandwiches and burgers in for him to eat and saying, come on, now you need to eat that quickly before it gets cold, to establish this dynamic of gratitude that he will open up.
Is it a dramatic reconstruction from the transcript?
No, it's the real thing. You see the real thing. The video is kind of blurry, and then sometimes you go away to a split screen of expert observers, including the British Guantanamo detainee Mohsen Beg, looking at it, telling us the kind of things that would be going through their mind. I found it a very good way of doing it, very good way of using as much as possible this extraordinary original material with insightful expert commentary.
What do you think the point of a documentary is like this? In a way, I was wondering, oh, another Guantanamo movie, is it still relevant? Oh, is it all part of a process of the part? Are we looking at how we used to do things, or are we saying that there's this kind of current relevance to all this?
I think it's a way of showing you what happens, because there's very little real material to showing us what happens inside Guantanamo. We know all about it, but we don't actually see it in real time. We don't actually see how it comes about. It's more insidious and horrible and incompetent and annoying. This guy's like a kind of annoying, nerdy guy who is bringing this 16-year-old to the point of suicide. I mean, clearly, if he could top himself, he would do so. And there is something horrifying about it. It's a matter of very great shame for the Canadian government, and it's a scandal which continues to grow that they failed to stand up for one of their own citizens,
yeah.
Failed to even to try to extradite him to have the sentence served at home. It's a growing kind of scandal and humiliation for them.
So the boys from South Park were right. We should bomb Canada.
We should blame Canada. Yeah. Well, Canada is blaming itself.
Nobody believes me. Sally, I trust you. And you can tell me anything, anything at all.
They don't like bright lights, you know. Those things.
They don't. And I have a good idea.
Peter, very quickly, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, I notice, is presented by Guillermo del Toro. And he does have a habit of these gothic mansion films. I'm thinking he did The Orphanage as a presenter, but he did Pan's Labyrinth.
Well, he wrote it. He adapted it from a 1973 TV horror, which I didn't know about. And he's changed it. What's happened is that the original was a couple move in and the wife suspects that there are weird predatory fairy creatures living in the basement. He's changed it so that there's a couple move in, played by Guy Pearce and Katie Holmes, and it's their disturbed child, of course, tellingly, very telling Guillermo del Toro touch, who thinks that there are these fairy creatures. I found it very interesting. It's very interesting for Guillermo del Toro fans to see how this relatively obscure TV movie obviously influenced him and how he's re-importing his own evolved language back into this
apparently
movie.
He used to watch it a lot with his mum and dad or his brothers.
Apparently it freaked him right out. Apparently it freaked him right out.
Is it a scary movie, do you think, this one? I
thought it was not bad.
Yeah, me too.
I thought it was not bad. I at the very beginning, I thought it lost it a bit towards the end because it was sort of a hybrid, you know. Are they after the wife, which is what they were in the original, or are they after the kid?
Yeah.
And by the end, the dramatic focus is slightly split and it loses a lot of its tension.
Briefly, Katie Holmes, I noticed. I mean, it's kind of from the ghost of the past. I hadn't seen her on screen for ages.
No, not for ages.
I kept thinking, she's married to Tom Cruise. How weird. I wondered if he was going to pop up any moment.
Yeah, he's going to be the tiny creature in the basement. Good role for him. One of his dark roles.
I think so. And normally they work out better.
Yeah.
What is she like?
She's not bad. I mean, she does a perfectly decent... It could have been anybody. Mm. I mean, it could be anybody at all, but she does a perfectly good job. And Guy Pearce, who, like Kevin Bacon, is the absolute mark of quality, without being particularly a star or showy, he's the mark, I think, of decent blue chip quality in a film, and so he is here.
He's there, and I thought the effects were rather good. I like the little creatures.
Yeah, the original, very, very Del Toro, very Guillermo del Toro, sort of a B-side to Pan's Labyrinth.
Yes.
I mean,
I rather enjoyed it, strangely enough.
Not bad.
I don't enjoy
not
that
bad.
Sort of thing. Yeah. So we won't be afraid of the dark, but what we will do is go back to 1920s Paris and a taste of Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris.
You know, I had such a crush on him in college, and Carol's very bright.
Really, he's a pseudo-intellectual, just a little bit.
Gil, I hardly think he'd be lecturing at the Sorbonne if he's a pseudo-intellectual. You should give him your book to read.
Come on, why?
No, because he could critique your writing and maybe show you why you're having so much trouble.
I'm having trouble because I'm a Hollywood hack who never gave actual literature a real shot.
Now, Peter, you and I saw this as opening night at Cannes Film Festival. I enjoyed it immensely.
I did enjoy it.
I'm always nervous for Woody because I sort of feel something for him. He's a cherished uncle of mine, even though, you know, we've only met a couple of times, but he doesn't pat me on the head. No. But I always feel that sometimes I watch things and I think, this is going to get a right kicking and I'm going to have to avert my eyes from the kind of vitriol that's been sort of heaped upon him.
Yeah.
And I still felt that in Cannes this year, that Midnight in Paris wasn't particularly appreciated. I really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it. I think it's actually better the second time when I saw it with a bunch of British critics who were laughing their heads off. It's reportedly his most commercially successful film ever. Which is sort of incredible. But it's smart, it's witty, it's got lots of nice light touches in it. And the time, I don't want to go to start spoiling it, but the time travel scenes are the best thing in it. My theory is that because he's uncomfortable in the present day now, much more so than ever, going back to the 20s is actually a great idea, and it's brought him, you know, brought up his style. It's good stuff. I don't know quite what to think of it. I really am split because some of the present day stuff doesn't work.
A little clunky, you think?
Clunky.
This is the bit with Owen Wilson and Michael Sheen having flirting
I'm thinking
with his wife, Rachel McAdams.
I'm thinking particularly of the final climactic confrontation between Owen Wilson and Rachel McAdams, and that, frankly, and as I say, by golly, I want to be nice to Woody Allen, but that doesn't work, to be honest with you. It's not a question of it being clunky. It sort of doesn't make sense. It doesn't really work. So that's my reservation. But on the other hand, my goodness, it is funny. I mean, you realise how much you've missed it I've missed it. I've missed it from him. I certainly miss it from everybody else.
We happen to see it. I mean, in Cannes, you see things very in quick succession. But we saw Midnight in Paris this week and then Johnny English Reborn.
Yeah.
And I thought, my God, if people have a go at Woody Allen. I mean, it is a titan of a movie compared to Johnny English.
And it's beautifully kind of paced in a way that sometimes Woody Allen rushes things.
I agree.
It's got a cracking...
It's elegant, is it not?
It's beautifully elegant. I can feel myself talking myself back into really liking it. I'm sort of swaying in a weird way between really liking it and worrying a bit about
the... Do you know what? I mean, I've just done a 10 best Woody Allen jokes for the Observer this coming weekend.
Yes.
And so I've been watching a lot of clips of Woody and going over his old scripts and stuff. This is his 42nd feature film.
Yeah.
He's never done... This, he's still finding new things to say about people who would live in the past. I mean, yes, the radio days was nostalgic, but this is actually about someone who is so nostalgic they prefer the past. They can invent themselves a past.
Yeah.
It's something original. And your 42nd movie, it's not bad to come up with something new.
It's remarkable.
Peter Bradshaw, an absolute treat to have you
aboard. My dear sir, a treat to be here.
We shall see you around, no doubt. London
Film
Festival coming up.
Oh, yes.
Flexing your muscles for that.
Oh, yes.
You're just back from San Sebastian as
well. I am.
You're stuffed with pinchos.
Oh, yes. Yes, as we call it in the Basque tongue.
Many thanks to Peter Bradshaw. Lovely to have him aboard. For all of Peter's reviews, just go to guardian.co.uk/film, or radically, you could just pick up a copy of The Guardian on Friday.
You look lost.
Oh, yeah. You're American?
If you count Alabama's American, which I do, I'm Mr. Bathtub Gin. What do you do?
Me, I'm a writer.
What do you write?
Oh, right now I'm working on a novel.
Oh, yes? I'm Zelda, by the way.
Right.
Oh, Scott?
Yeah.
Scott!
Yes, what is it, sweetheart?
Here's a writer from where?
Writer. California. Scott Fitzgerald. And who are you, old sport? Gil... The same names as...
As what?
You know, Scott Fitzgerald and...
Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald, the Fitzgeralds. Isn't she beautiful?
Yes, yes.
Now, as Peter Bradshaw and I were discussing earlier, Kenneth Branagh once played one of Woody Allen's lead roles in the film Celebrity. Ironic, then, that one of Branagh's own protégés, Tom Hiddleston, now finds himself playing Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris. Hiddleston was spotted by Branagh in Joanna Hogg's brilliant film Unrelated. He then played opposite Ken in BBC series Wallander before Ken cast young Hiddleston as Loki in his blockbuster Thor earlier this year. This week, Tom steps into the soft shoes of F. Scott Fitzgerald in 1920s Paris in Woody Allen's film. But his career is going stellar, both here in the present and in Hollywood, from where he's just come back filming blockbuster superhero mashup The Avengers. So how delightful to welcome one of Britain's hottest acting talents on the end of the line. Hello, Tom, old sport.
Thank you very much, old sport.
Now, did you do much research on getting on to F. Scott Fitzgerald? I mean, the whole kind of flannel wearing, you suit him marvellously, I have to say.
Thank you very much. Actually, strangely, I only had about 3 weeks between the end of shooting Thor and the beginning of shooting Midnight in Paris. So one of my... It's going to sound ridiculous, but one of my main concerns was trying to strip the black dye out of my hair.
It's a big concern.
It's a big concern because Woody Allen had seen my... I think he hadn't met me in person, but he'd seen some stuff I'd done before.
Well, do you know what had he seen Unrelated? Had he seen Archipelago?
I think he'd seen a cut of different things on my kind of showreel.
A little Tom montage.
A little montage there. It's a little bit of a... Joanna Hogg stuff, a little bit of Cranford thrown in for good measure.
You don't want anyone to miss Cranford. But I suppose it quite helped because he probably thought, oh, period, nice, he can do that kind of gentlemanly thing. Because if he'd only seen, I don't know, Thor, for example, which I obviously wouldn't have because you'd just come for filming it.
Yeah.
But he would have thought, I don't know about this guy.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know exactly what he saw, but it was very strange because as soon as I looked Fitzgerald up, there aren't that many pictures of him, but I don't look that far away from what he must have looked like at my age.
Now, I think you were quite similar.
Yeah, sort of facial structure. Yeah. And it's a strange thing, and I had no idea that I looked like F. Scott Fitzgerald until Woody Allen told me that I did.
Well, there's not much trade in lookalike-y agencies for F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah, no.
But that said, I think all of you in Midnight in Paris seem to look rather like the people that you're supposed to look like, even though I never lived in the 20s and you only get faded sepia photographs. But Zelda looks pretty Zelda-ish. Porter looks pretty Cole Porter-ish.
Yeah, well, we're trying quite hard, and his hair and makeup department, his costume department, were amazing at all of this stuff because Corey Stoll is actually who plays Hemingway, has a lot less hair than that in real life, but actually, I think Woody had seen him in a production in New York of A View from the Bridge, with Leo Schreiber and Scarlett Johansson, and in that he'd been wearing a wig too. So he was sort of like, we were all kind of picked for the right reasons. But it was a strange thing, because with Woody you have no rehearsal. You get sent your pages. I mean, people like myself and Alison Pill, who plays Zelda, and Corey, who plays Hemingway, and Adrian Brody, who plays Dali.
Dali. Bates.
Dali. Rhinoceros.
He's great. And, it's the best things he's done.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And Kathy Bates, I know, because we discussed it, we'd all only seen our scenes. We didn't know the whole story. And I had about a day and a half in Paris before I was due to shoot. And we were all frantically kind of sharing information. Alison Pill and I sat on the roof of our hotel reading each other Scott and Zelda's letters, just to kind of get some kind of, to get something into our bones before we were supposed to act. Like,
yeah, I suppose the rhythm of the time, the kind of the words. I mean, her in particular, she has that, I'm stupefied.
Yeah, stupefied, lobotomized, anesthetized, yeah. I'm bored. Yeah. but it was just huge fun. And I did as much research as I could in terms of trying to get a flavor of that time, the roaring 20s, the golden age, and the hotbed of creativity that Paris must have been. And the fact that they all didn't know they were going to be icons. They were just artists who nobody had heard of, particularly, who happened to be rubbing shoulders with each other. But that's the message of the film.
I love that conceit as well. I remember Bertrand Tavernier, who was on the show when his film The Princess of Montpensier came out recently, and he was sort of, I said, oh, it's very youthful, your kind of characters, even though they're kings and queens. He said, well, you see, they don't know they're historical characters. To them, they're just young people growing up in the 16th century, so they act like young people because they've got no idea of their history. And that it's exactly what I was thinking watching you lot kind of mince about in 20th century. You had no idea of your own greatness. Of course, Hemingway thought he was rather fantastic.
Hemingway knew he was great at that time. Yes, yeah.
He was. I hope you didn't box with him.
I didn't, no. We watched a lot of football. The World Cup was on while we were shooting, so we did a lot of football watching.
Tom, it was only a year ago that, a year ago in a couple of days, that I sat next to you at the opening night of the London Film Festival last year, and there you were, and you were about to, you'd done Archipelago with Joanne Hogg.
Yeah.
And you were about to do Deep Blue Sea with Terence Davis, which is now closing the London Film Festival this year. You hadn't been in a Woody Allen film. You hadn't been in a Steven Spielberg film. You hadn't even been low-key yet, I think, or maybe you just come back from filming it. You know, suddenly, in a year, do you know what I'm saying is that I doubt I'll be allowed to sit next to you this year.
I don't know about that, Jason. I'm sure we could arrange it if you'd like.
On your lap.
There you go, yeah. I'm not picky about who I sit next to at these occasions. It's been an amazing time. It's one of those, I'm still coming down from the mountain, or I'm still pinching myself, and I actually went back to my old drama school last night. They asked me to come back and sort of give a talk. And one of my old teachers said, so how is it that you did 4 years of theatre work with very classical material and then you've literally done six films back to back? And my honest answer is, I have no idea. Because it's just, you kind of, as actors, we're just putting one foot in front of the other and making the best of what's available on the day.
Yes, that's true. And I don't suppose you can plan that at all. As you say, you've got no idea that you can eat, but that's such a mix. I mean, you've been anything, you were low-key, but you've been nothing but low-key since. But you've been in the 50s, you've been in the 20s. Yeah, I don't know when Thor was set, technically.
Thor's set now, because Natalie Portman's from right now.
Yeah, I know, but you're not. I mean, you're a Norse god.
Yeah, we're from the future.
And there are a lack of those. I'm trying to get one to do my house at the moment. You can't get a Norse god when you need one.
You need the Norse god of what? Painting and decorating?
Painting and decorating.
I'm not quite sure who that is.
Scaffolding, yes. So the 50s, Rattigan, 20s, I don't even know where else you've been. But it's
Well, I've been in 1914 for War Horse.
For War Horse, 1914. Yeah. So in a way, what is interesting is watching you in Midnight in Paris, which is about someone who wants to live in a nostalgia shop in an old, you are the only people, you actors are actually able to do that. You are able to put on a costume and zip back and forth in time, like Ben Johnson's Alchemist. You can just curtain can fall on you, zip, and you're off.
That's an amazing way of putting it, and I'm going to steal it if I may.
You should wish you can go back to school tonight.
Yeah, I know, and say this is what I've been doing. I've been like Ben Johnson's Alchemist. Okay, do you get the reference? Thank you. It's truly a privilege to be able to do that, and I guess just to live in the shoes of I mean, that's really what acting is living in other people's shoes for a while and seeing how the truth looks different for through different eyes.
I'm gonna ask you then, like Owen Wilson's character, like the Woody character, like Midnight in Paris begs as a question. Any favourite era?
Oh, that's a very good question. I'd love to have been around in kind of old Hollywood, you know, that sort of to have just seen what it must have been like around sort of when I don't know, Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis were making Some Like It Hot. Or...
Oh, okay. Not really. Or not like the art. Not like Talkies Come Silent with the art. With when you know that film, The Artist. I don't know if you've had the privilege.
Really looking forward to seeing that. That looks absolutely amazing.
That would be great for you. That era, yeah. I think, with a little moustache, little kind of princey, kind of little drawn on moustache, little cocktail, white jacket. I see you.
Yeah, I'm there. I'm right there. Let's make it.
Excellent. The new David Niven. I'm going to christen you, Tom.
Oh, thank you so much.
Wouldn't that be cool? Yeah, now you've got to write some great autobiographies. That's the only problem with that.
And he's probably written the best of all time.
Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure to watch you grow. I can't wait to. I haven't seen The Deep Blue Sea yet, and I haven't seen War Horse, obviously. And we'll hopefully.
No one's seen War Horse. No. I haven't seen it either.
Is it going to be good?
I think that actually, I just saw a new trailer that they put online this morning, and I have a sense that it's going to be really, truly breathtaking. I mean, the experience of shooting it was probably one of the high points, not just of my working life, but of my life.
Wow.
And working with Steven Spielberg, he's a genius and a master filmmaker and a very, very, very nice man.
Yeah, you've been hanging out with a lot of geniuses. As Woody Allen would say in Manhattan, you should hang out with some stupid people sometimes. You might learn something.
Well, it's funny because Woody's genius is much quieter than Steven's. I remember the first and only thing he said to me on my first day, Woody Allen, was, "So Tom, you look Scotty." Thank you very much, Woody. I'll take it. I'll take it. I suppose it's better than...
Oh, Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, great. I'm not Scotty from Star Trek.
No. You look Scotty.
Brilliant. Well, I'm sure he knew him very well. Tom, you do a lovely Scott Fitzgerald. I'm sure you do a lovely martini as well. Congratulations on Midnight in Paris and on your career this year. And I'll see you around the London Film Festival.
Yeah, see you then, Jason. Thank you.
As you heard, we'll be seeing a lot more of Tom Hiddleston on the big screen soon. That's all for this week. Thanks to my guests, to Tom Hiddleston and to Paddy Considine and Olivia Colman and Peter Bradshaw, of course. The music we've been featuring on the show this week is from the soundtrack to Midnight in Paris, the very appropriate Sidney Bechet, a Woody favourite, and rightly so. The track is Si tu vois ma mère. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for my trailer trash, of course, and for that 10 best Woody Allen gags feature. You can argue with me about those online, of course. But until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.